has a very specific, very narrow band, high Q resonant frequency. You need that characteristic in order to get this extremely sharp filtering you need in order to create 120 decibels or more of isolation across a frequency region of only 600 kc separation at 146 megacycles. So that's one of the most extreme cases of very sharp filtering. Therefore, you need the highest possible Q.
Repeater, timeout.
You need the highest possible Q, and only that cavity resonator can do it for you. And maybe certain kinds of ceramic resonators might also be able to do it. Every one of your cell phones has a duplexing filter built into it, made out of extremely high dielectric constant ceramic material, barium tetratitanate. I think it's got a velocity factor, or a dielectric constant of 100. That means it shrinks the size down by 10 to 1. So there is a duplexing filter in your cell phone. The cell phone usually has one single antenna that is simultaneously transmitting on one frequency and receiving on another frequency. And they both go to that exact same antenna, the transmitting and receiving function. And so that your cell phone receiver doesn't become desensitized by the cell phone transmitter, there's a duplexing filter in there. And it usually has six resonators built into a ceramic structure that is all something like 3/4 of an inch long and wide, and maybe 1/4 of an inch thick. There's a duplexing filter in most cell phones. AC2IS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Bill.
This is AC2IS, and please let me know if I'm, monopolizing the airwaves here with this question. I can try to do some reading online instead, maybe. But it sounded like you said that that center threaded rod does not carry any energy, but that the resonator is coaxial, so that's confusing to me. I thought that in your typical coaxial setup that there was current carried on the center conductor. You mentioned six cavities in a cell phone, and six cavities is typical for, a repeater's duplexer. So I'm wondering if there's something special about those six cavities. Is six cavities somehow a magic number, you know, that you could not do the job with two cavities, just but with less isolation? Or is it just that maybe six cavities finally is a number of cavities you need before you get the isolation you need? AC2IS.
Most 6 meter and 440, most 6 meter, here we go, most 2 meter repeaters have six cavities. You could say three of those cavities are favoring the receiver frequency, three of those cavities are favoring the transmitter frequency. There are a few duplexing filters you can buy that have only four cavities. They don't have anywhere near as much isolation. If you're running a very low power repeater, you may get away with four cavities, but most of them use six. If you took a cross section, if you took the center of that cavity resonator on 2 meters for that duplexing filter and sawed right across the middle of it, you'd find an outer diameter of roughly 4 inches. The reentrant rod that does the resonating has an outside diameter of maybe inch and a half, and it's between the outer surface of the inch and a half and the inner surface of the 4 inch that is the coaxial line, that is the resonator. Inside of the 1.5 inch diameter reentrant rod is a piece of threaded rod that's in a shielded structure. It goes down the center of the 1.5 inch diameter center conductor. No RF energy is there. That threaded rod is in a shielded structure, even though it's going down the dead center of this cavity resonator. Outside of inch and a half and inside of the 4 inches, all hell is going on. Tremendous signals are there. But no RF signal is on that threaded rod that's on the inside of the of the 1.5-inch diameter reentrant rod. Does that make some sense, Bill? Over to you, K2RIW.
AC2IS here. Yeah, I think I see what I must have missed. It sounds like you're saying that each of these resonating cavities is not a single cylinder, but a pair of nested cylinders. The threaded rod is inside the inner nested cylinder, and so the threaded rod itself is shielded by that inner cylinder. Is that correct, AC2IS?
You've got it, Bill. That threaded rod is a tuning assembly. It has no RF energy on it. When it comes to high Q resonators, you must never put RF energy through a threaded structure, because where RF energy is flowing through the threads and then it has to be grounded by a nut, the exact place where the thread gets grounded by the nut is never twice the same spot. You get a scratchy contact there. There are people who have built tuning mechanisms that use RF energy flowing through a male and female screw, a threaded rod and a nut. It's not a reliable structure. The RF energy is flowing through just the very last fraction of a turn of the outer thread, and eventually the RF current, if it's a transmitter, will create galling and failure, scratchy contacts. The 1.5-inch diameter inner resonator of a cavity resonator inside of the 4-inch diameter outer diameter, that piston on the end of it is also very close to 1.5 inches in diameter, with finger stock where the piston moves in and out of, and so the whole circumference of that piston is being grounded by the finger stock. The threaded rod is just pushing and pulling on that piston, changing that length to change the resonant frequency. So, with rare exceptions, don't put RF energy onto threaded rods. I think this is as far as we should go tonight, Bill. Let's see if you've got anything, any last little things that need clear up on this. AC2IS, K2IW, the TechNet.
This is AC2IS. Yeah, I could probably spend a lot more time on this, and that's probably not the best way to spend time on the TechNet today. We could save this question for next week, but I was wondering, it seemed like of the resonating cavities, three of them were bridged with inductors, three of them were bridged with capacitors, and since it seems like one set of three simply favors one frequency and the other set of three favors another frequency, why would one be bridged with inductors and the other with capacitors? Seems like it should be the same on both, but that's not what I saw on the one thing I looked at. So yeah, maybe you could answer that next week, AC2IS.
If I had a simple cavity resonator, Bill, with an input coupling loop and an output coupling loop on a single cavity resonator, and I plotted the frequency bandpass, I would have a Gaussian-shaped filter where the center of the Gaussian curve is where the thing is resonated, and it would be a thoroughly symmetric Gaussian shape, response versus frequency. If I now add series capacitors going into that coupling loop, that's the output connector of that cavity, I will create a non-symmetric bandpass. It'll have a very sharp skirt on one side and a broad skirt on the other side. That's if I do it with capacitors. And I'm not quite sure now. If I do it with capacitors, I think I have a sharp skirt on the low side. If I do it with inductors, I have a sharp skirt on the high side. So now, the transmitting frequency is usually lower. Let me think now. The transmitting frequency of a repeater, let me drop it. The transmitting frequency is usually higher on a repeater. The receiving frequency is usually lower on 146 megacycles. As such, I want a very sharp skirt on the low side of the transmitting three cavities to protect the receiver. I want, and the receiver cavities are tuned lower. I want a very sharp skirt on the high side of those cavities. So to make sure I have a sharp skirt on the high side of the receiver frequency and a sharp skirt on the low side of the transmitter frequency cavities, you now know why three of them have inductive coupling and three of them have capacitive coupling. You're using the non-symmetric filter characteristics you can get when there is an extra reactor added to the coupling assembly to that cavity filter. This is part of the magic of how you get that 120 dB of isolation between the transmitter and the receiver, even though they're both going into this exact same assembly. Over to you, Bill. K2LIW.
AC2IS. It sounds like you said that one of the series of cavities is a high pass, the other series of cavities is a low pass. Is that correct, AC2IS?
Basically, no. If I have nothing but an input coupling loop and an output coupling loop of a single cavity, and I plot the bandpass on a very low insertion loss at the center frequency, that's the center of the Gaussian curve of response versus frequency. There's an upper skirt and the lower skirt of the filter, and they're identical looking skirts. That's an ordinary cavity resonator with an input coupling loop and an output coupling loop. If I now make the coupling loops have an additional series capacitor going to the final output connector, or an additional series inductor, that Gaussian shaped bandpass starts becoming non-symmetric. The upper skirt and the lower skirt are no longer identical. One skirt gets sharp and the other skirt gets a little bit broad, and whether it's the upper skirt or the lower skirt that gets sharp is a function of whether or not I've added an extra capacitor to the coupling loop or an extra inductor. So the three cavities that are favoring the transmitter is the higher frequency on a 6 meter repeater. I want to have a sharp skirt on the low side of that bandpass of each of those three transmitter cavities. I want to reject that signal real fast on the low side because that lower skirt is moving in the direction of the receiver frequency. And the three receiver cavities, which is the lower frequency, I want to make sure I have a very sharp skirt on the upper side of those cavities. So I'm intentionally creating non-symmetric Gaussian-shaped curves on each of these cavities, and whether I favor the high side or the low side with the sharp skirt is a function of, is it a receiver cavity or a transmitter cavity? But I want the two...
Repeater, timeout.
I want the sharp skirt on the low side of the transmitter cavities, the higher frequency cavities, and I want the sharp skirt on the upper side of the receiver cavities. I want those two sharp skirts of the adjacent cavities, transmitter cavity and receiver cavities, facing each other, so I now get the maximum isolation between the two. Because when those two skirts overlap each other in frequency, that is the isolation between transmitter and receiver. Does that make a little more sense, Bill? Over to you, K2LIW.
Okay, I'm, I guess, changing my impression of what you said to, I guess, a Gaussian curve, if it's symmetric, is a bell curve, and then if you use these bridging inductors or capacitors, it's no longer a symmetric bell curve, but it gets much steeper and sharper, cut off on one side or the other of the bell curve. AC2IS.
You've now got it, Bill. And with loose vocabulary, you could call those cavities high pass or low pass. That's not really what they are. It's a non-symmetric Gaussian-like curve that favors the frequency you've got to reject. So at the transmit frequencies, you've got to have a very sharp rejection at the lower frequencies, which are toward the receiver. And the receiver has to have very sharp rejection on the upper frequencies that favor the transmitter. And so when you see this all plotted together, you want the sharpness of those transmitter curves and receiver curves facing each other. And so when those two curves overlap at some frequency, that's where the isolation happens. And you're looking for something like 120 dB of isolation. 120 dB rolls off the tongue very easily. Let's see, 120 dB, I think that's a trillion to one power ratio. Over to you, Bill, K2RIW.
Okay, I'll take your word for that. A trillion to one sounds impressive. I think we've covered this subject adequately for today. Maybe I'll have some more questions next week. AC2IS.
Yeah, there are smart guys who have homebrewed the cavity resonator filters. It's a fair amount of work. If you've got the money, it's easy to just go out and buy a respected brand name. But to make the duplexing filter of a repeater have all the performance you want, to maintain that performance year after year, and many repeaters are mounted in an environment where it's cold in the winter and hot in the summer and so on, high humidity and whatever, to make a duplexing filter give you high reliability, low insertion loss, and high isolation, and maintain it day in and day out, that's a pretty stiff requirement. And so it takes a lot of care to make that all come about. The copper that you use in the cavity resonator has got a certain amount of thermal expansion coefficient. Let me drop. So the cavity resonator in general is going to grow larger at higher temperatures and therefore tune itself to a lower frequency. So you've got to put some kind of compensating network in there to correct for that. And the where the reentrant rod hits the low end, the short circuit end of this cavity, inside of the 4-inch diameter outer conductor, the 1.5-inch diameter rod at the short circuit end at the bottom, just using ordinary solder there might not be good enough. That bottom end, in order for the 5,000 Q to be maintained, you would like the resistance between that center rod and the outer structure, you would like that resistance to be either micro-ohms or nano-ohms. An ordinary solder joint down there might not do that for you, and therefore you can end up with a lot of loss down there because the circulating currents can be very high down there. If the cavity has a Q of 5,000, that means the current that you apply somewhere inside that cavity is being multiplied by 5,000. You put 1 ampere of RF energy into that cavity resonator. At the bottom of that reentrant rod, 5,000 amperes are flowing. And if you don't have nano-ohms of resistivity down there, you're going to be dissipating power. It's going to run hot, and you're going to run lower in Q, and you're going to lose some of your beautiful filter characteristics. So as you can tell, there's some art and science about the details as to how you actually carry this out. Now, getting back to putting human beings on Mars. It's very nice science fiction, Paul, to think you could take a human being and put him into hibernation. And so that for the 6 months or a year that it takes to travel to Mars, rather than have him have 6 months or 12 months of boredom, you'd like to put him to sleep, and you'd like him to consume energy at 1/10 the rate. I mean, you can take a bear who hibernates in the wintertime, and his metabolism goes down to some very low rate during that hibernation. He's using very little food and fuel during that period of time, and he's not ingesting any water. A bear is specifically designed by Mother Nature to do that. A human being is not. We can dream about putting a human being into hibernation. I'm having trouble thinking that you're going to do that without creating brain damage. Under normal circumstances, a living, breathing, alive human being is metabolizing food, air, and water. Let me drop at the rate of 130 watts, 450 BTU per hour, 130 joules per second of energy is flowing through that human being in order to keep him alive, to keep all of his organs running and whatever. 24/7, you know, if you were pumping your bicycle, making electrical power into a generator to keep a 130-watt light bulb lit at full brilliance, that takes a lot of work. your muscles in your leg would get tired pretty fast doing that. That amount of energy must flow through a human being 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, in order for that human being to be alive and living well. That's a lot of energy. It has to come from somewhere. You have to be supplying him food, water, and air of just the right components continuously to do that. We seem to forget about that. If you were designing the air conditioning system for a theater, and you've got people sitting in your great big opera theater, each one of those human beings sitting in the seat, if they're not jumping up and down and screaming, they're dissipating 450 BTU, 130 watts of power, of heat is coming off of each one of those human beings because of his metabolism, because he's sitting in that seat. And if you've got 1,000 people in that theater, you better have a lot of BTUs of air conditioning, otherwise that theater is going to get very hot very soon.
Question, Dick?
Go right ahead, John.
AC2WGB. Well, Dick, you know with the astronauts that we send up to the space station and all this stuff, they exercise constantly to keep muscle tone. How are you going to, you put a guy in suspended animation for a year, what's going to happen to the muscle tissue with atrophy?
Take an animal that's specifically designed to do that, a bear that's hibernating. He loses quite a bit of his stored fat, stored energy. But his muscle mass, per se, does not go down. He's specifically designed to do that. Could a human being do that? I'm very doubtful. And by the way, the human being, while he's exercising, he's not consuming 130 watts of energy. He's probably consuming 170 watts of energy, if you know what I mean. It's got to come from somewhere. So supplying the raw food, air, and water to keep a human being happy and alive. I mean, you can see what's happening with the International Space Station. Those progress ships, every couple of months, are bringing tons of consumables up to those astronauts to maintain their lifestyle, to keep them alive. To do that on a multi-year mission to Mars, not so easy. For all of these smart space organizations, let me drop, to be designing hardware that at some future time is capable of doing that, that's a worthwhile endeavor. Because whenever you design good space hardware, good boosters, and good capsules for human beings, and good life support systems and whatever, you'll always find some way of using it. Whether you're specifically going to use it for a Mars mission in the next 10, 20, or 30 years, that's debatable. But it's a good, it's a crazy-sounding goal, but it does give you a beneficial piece of hardware development. I can accept that. But to really send human beings to Mars with what we now know is there. I mean, a Curiosity spacecraft walking around Mars, making all these measurements and mailing the data home. That makes a lot of sense. A human being can gather that data a little bit faster, and he's a little bit more adaptable. But to get that human being there without really heavily damaging him, to get him there alive, to keep him happy while he's there, and to send him on a one-way mission where he can never come back to his family and his friends, there's something wrong with that picture. And the whole time he's there, he's living in what is essentially a vacuum. He can't go out of his habitat without wearing a spacesuit. And we've already discussed what wearing a spacesuit for 8 hours is like. And portions of that function is not pleasant. And to do that day in and day out, to do your farming and roving and testing and laboratory measurements and whatever, I'm having trouble envisioning that. But maybe I'm overly negative. WS2N, K2RIW. Over to you, Paul.
They have a long way to go. But it would definitely have to be some kind of greenhouse. And then to create 14.7 pounds in the greenhouse, that would be an engineering feat to keep the panels tight. With that kind of pressure, because it's almost zero on the outside, 1/10 of 1%.
So that means what they are working on is growing plants at a lower pressure. I know they are working on that. So, you know, they're all taking baby steps. The trick is to get all this ready before, let's say, 2035 is going to be a tough job. Elon Musk, I guess he just figures he'll build a big enough rocket and bring everything with him. So I don't know how many frozen white castles you can bring with you. I guess it would stay for 3 years. You need a... Well, he wants to reduce the amount of time. He wants to get there instead of 6 or 8 months, he wants to do it in 4 months. And then he has plans on eventually sending people back if you'd like to go. It's not one-way trips. You're thinking of that one Mars group, which is I think kind of shady. And I've read a lot about. People have signed up, but that is not going to happen. I don't trust that guy. Bass, his name is. Let me drop. Okay, so. I wanted to mention something that John brought up a while back, a couple of months, I guess a month or two ago. He wanted to know how New Horizons was doing. So let me just tell him that, and then if you want to go back to colonizing Mars, we can. But New Horizons is still operating, doing very good, and they've gotten their last bit of data from that spacecraft that went past Pluto and its five moons 2 years ago, two July 4th ago. So they said it was going to take about 16 months to get all the data back, and that's about what it was. It was basically 400 different measurements that took place during that pass, and it equaled about 50 gigabytes of data that had to be transmitted back to Earth, all on RRF. But it's still functioning, and they have an extended mission that's being funded. Let me drop it. Out to a Kuiper object. I think it's about 30 miles in diameter. And that'll happen on January 1st, 2019. So 3 years down the road. Almost 3 years. Now they're going to require a lot more memory on board to do that. They are sending a command up to New Horizon to delete all the information that they sent back for the last 16 months, so that they'll have plenty of memory storage for the next encounter. John, I just want to pass that over to you. I know you asked that a while back, but got a little lost. KC2BGWS.
Yes, Paul, thank you for that info. I was wondering, also I asked, maybe you know, it's headed for where? Where is its next contact point of interest, if you know that information?
Yeah, it's like I said, it's about 30 miles in diameter, and they're giving it the number 2014, the year that they really came up with this thing. And then the designation is MU, Mike Uniform 69. So if you put MU 69 in your computer, you come up with an artist's idea of what this thing might look like. John, back to you.
And how much travel time do we have to wait before it reaches that point, if you know?
And how close is it going to get? I presume it's going to do another flyby and make a bunch of measurements of Polka.
Yeah, it's going to get a lot closer than 6,000 miles when it went past Pluto. So, you know, it is a smaller object, so they can figure on that. Yeah, January 1st, 2019. You got a couple of years, John. They have a half a dozen instruments on board that they gave names, Ralph, Alice, you know, these are all cameras and things that detector, infrared, ultraviolet, radio waves. That's how they redefined the atmosphere on Pluto. They thought it was one certain thickness, and they sent a radio wave, a radio signal through the atmosphere when Pluto, when it was Pluto was in between the spacecraft and Earth, and they got a better idea of what, you know, how thick the atmosphere was. They're going to do all this with this Kuiper belt. All the instruments are up and running, still work. Dick, over to you.
On multiple occasions, Paul, when I went to the NASA site where they showed you what each one of the Deep Space Network ground station antennas were doing, there were many hours in which Goldstone and other major dishes were listening to New Horizons, listening to the downlink, hours on end, gathering all of that data. I think you said the estimation was something like 16 months were required. No, was it 16 months? Like, year and a half. The data that they gathered during the flyby, the gigabytes of data, took a long time to ship it down. And I think the downlink rate was it like half a kilohertz, or do you remember what was the bit rate of the downlink from New Horizons to the Deep Space Network? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
You do the math. I know it was 50 gigabytes, so give you an idea of every, when you get a CD that, you know, that you're going to put in your CD machine to play a movie, that's usually 4.5 gig. And this is 50 of them, so, you know, 50 gigs. Now, you know, the signal, of course, is coming back. I think it was on KU. I think it was lower of the two. But, you know, by the time it gets back to Earth, you know, the signal is, like, wider than Earth itself. I'm thinking that laser, that would, you know, you might have gotten it down to the size of United States. There was a test going on about with that too. 2019, they're going to launch a rocket with a laser, and they're going to run some tests from the moon. I believe that's going to go up on a SpaceX rocket, but you know, because of that distance. The data rate was relatively low. It did take 16 months to do that 50 gig right there.
16 months from the beginning of the downlinking until the end. But I don't think that 16 months was 24/7 downlinking. I don't think the dishes were always available. Is that true, Paul?
Like you see on the Deep Space Network, they're always sharing, you know. And now they're involved a little bit with Trace is now in orbit around Mars. So you've got, I think, about 14, 15 deep space objects that they're always communicating with. And, yeah, the whole time they can't get, they can't occupy the whole time just with one. So, you know, pick a time frame, probably 8 hours a day. And it's not quite. They predicted 16 months, but it was July, so it's really. I think they beat it by a month. I think it's 15 months. Back to you, Dick.
Now, you thought that the dish would be aimed at the United States, for instance, the dish on New Horizons. The dish on New Horizons, I'm going to assume it was approximately 12 feet in diameter. 12 feet in diameter, and I believe the frequency was 8.5 gigahertz downlink. You go through that calculation, it has a beam width of 0.67 degree. 0.67 degree means that by the time the signal goes 39 astronomical units, if you downlinked immediately as you pass by Pluto, 39 astronomical units, 0.67 degree beamwidth. I'm about to do the calculation, but it probably is a beam that by the time it gets down to us might be 50 Earths in diameter. That's a rough guess on my part. Do you think when you got a beam with a 50 Earths in diameter, you think you can aim it at the United States and not favor Europe? No way. I'm gonna do that calculation right now as to how big is the beam. So that beam coming down, even though it's very sharp, you and I think, let me drop it.
I read somewhere that they said it was just off, it was definitely over the size of Earth, but not, they didn't say 30 Earths.
Okay, the laws of physics say it's 0.67 degrees in diameter, and 39, I'm going to tell you how many miles wide is that beam in the next 5 minutes or so. And physics tells me that a 10-foot or a 12-foot diameter dish at 8.5 gigahertz, you can't get a sharper beam than that. That's the best focusing you're going to do. It's a very sharp beam, and you better aim, the spacecraft better have very precise aiming, so that that beam doesn't completely miss the Earth. But you think it's only one Earth in diameter. I doubt that, Paul. Let's see, we've got 14 minutes to go.
Do your calculations. I'd like to put a call in and see if Dr. Roy is listening.
Okay. Paul, choose any subject for the next 4 minutes, and I'll complete this calculation as to how big is the beam by the time it gets down to Earth, when it was launched at right at Pluto. And as you go beyond Pluto, by the time that beam is further and further away from us, it's getting wider and wider. So back to you, Paul, for a few minutes while I do this calculation. K2RIW.
I think it's around 3. Oh, well, not 3. Probably 2.8, something like that. But let's call it 3 AU per year. So... Now, instead of 39, you're looking at 42. There's a, not from this country, but another country called China. They have a launch coming up on November 3rd. And they're using a brand new rocket called the Long March 5. I think I said this last week or the week before, but they have four booster rockets attached to it, all running on liquid kerosene, as well as the main engine, the main core. So this is going to be a heavy lift vehicle, very similar to the Ariane 5 rocket that European Space Agency uses, or even our Delta Heavy, which is the biggest rocket that we could launch at this time until the SLS comes online, and that's really three Delta five rockets that are Delta four rockets that are attached to one another, strapped together. So this, you know, they're coming into the big leagues. Let me drop it. This is the same rocket that they're going to launch the future space station. They have, you know, Chang'an 3 is coming online. That would be in 2018. And that would be the first launch of the first module, and they're going to send a series of them up and interconnect them, and that should be completed by 2023. But they need this Long March rocket to do it. This will also be their future lunar craft. You know, they want to launch. They got goals of going to the moon, so they need the Long March 5 rocket. And they're launching it out of their new launch facility. They have a Haiyan launch complex that they built in the southern part of China, right along the China Sea. So that'll do it. I mean, we have a little bit of a space race going. We're way ahead, but you know. Don't look behind you. They're right behind you. Dick, maybe you got that figured. K2RIW, WS2N.
Okay, I'm going to show you how I did this, Paul. 0.67 degrees beamwidth you take the tangent of that to find out what the course track beam width. Tangent of that is 1.16, 10 to the minus 2. I assume that Pluto is 39 astronomical units. Maybe it's only 36. 39 astronomical units. One astronomical unit is 93 million miles. You multiply that out, that beam is 42 million miles wide when it gets to the Earth. The beam is 42 million miles wide. That's 5,000 Earth diameters. I'm going to double check this. I may have slipped a couple of decimal places. WS2N, K2IW.
Maybe we have to talk to an antenna maven.
Well, they said it was bigger than the Earth. Oh, wow. So, yeah, well, that gives you an idea. The signal rate, the bit rate is really decreased. And that's why it took so long. Wow. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, it would be nice if you had a laser transmitter that can try to transmit a very fine beam that's not 0.63 degrees wide. You can get lasers that are 100 times sharper than that. That's the good news. But now you need extremely precise aiming of the spacecraft to aim that beam toward Earth. When you get that very sharp laser beam, if you miss the Earth by a few diameters, you got no communication. So if I did the calculation correct, that beam, by the time it gets to us, 39 astronomical units away, is 42 million miles wide. And so, to think you're aiming it at the United States versus Europe, craziness. As you can see, 0.001% of the signal actually hits Earth. A hell of a lot of it goes out to the sides of the Earth. That's why you need a goldstone dish 240 feet in diameter to gather enough of that signal. And even then, let me drop.
I'm sure by you coming.
I'm guessing they're transmitting that signal at something like a couple of kilohertz, kilobits per second. George, go ahead with your comment. KD2FIU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Rich. Maybe a major modification of the entire satellite system and the number of satellites, their positions, and what the particular country wants out of that satellite system. So it's not a matter of just beaming it into a specific point on Earth. It's beaming it into your portion of the satellite network that's part of your country or whatever.
You're assuming that we could gather the signal coming from New Horizon being transmitted down to Earth by way of satellite. Absolutely not, George. The signal coming from New Horizons with the sharpest possible focus you can get from a 12-foot diameter dish that's on the back end of that satellite, aiming that 8.5 gigahertz signal toward us, gives it 0.67 degrees of beam width, half power beam width. When that signal comes down to us, it's an extremely wide signal, maybe 5,000 Earths wide. The only way you can get enough of that signal is to have a lot of capture area of your receiving antenna. The 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, and there's a similar one in Spain and a similar one in Australia, depending on which end of the Earth is aimed toward Pluto. Let me drop. As the Earth rotates, you make sure you're using the right dish at the right time. You need a lot of capture area to capture enough of that energy of that signal to be above the noise threshold of your receiver. You can put a zillion satellites out there. The satellites don't have anywhere near the receiving area of their receiving antennas compared to the 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone. I mean, that's what a 240 feet, I think it's an acre, it's almost an acre of antenna. If I got that right, yeah. It's about an acre of antenna that's gathering the signal. There aren't quite many satellites you can put up with an antenna that big, so to get enough signal to be above threshold, you need a lot of area. So put up as many satellites as you want. You're not going to hear that signal from New Horizons, is my guess, though, George. KD2 FIU, KQIW in the TechNet.
KD2RY. Okay, now what if we were to have the receiving antennas on the poles of the Earth? Let's go all the way with it. Go on the poles of the Earth and then reflecting it into the satellites to bring it back into where we want it on Earth.
On paper, it's a good sounding idea, as I see it, George. But don't forget now, each of these poles on the Earth are at a different latitude and a different longitude. The Earth is continuously rotating. All of those signals getting to the reflectors on all of your poles are going in and out of phase. You've got a very complicated network to make sure that all of those signals add at some particular focal point all in phase. Even if I had two Goldstone dishes side by side, one dish is further east and the other one's further west, and as the Earth rotates, they're moving at a different distance to the New Horizons spacecraft. Just to make the phases come out correct of two dishes side by side, you'd be amazed how complicated that is. So, sounds good on paper. To really do it would be extremely difficult. Let's see what Dave's got to say. KG2RY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dave.
Roger, Dave, K2RIW, KG2RY. You know, I think of satellite communications and reflection of signals, I think of XDR. Why do I think of XDR? Does XDR think of XDR? Go ahead.
Okay. I know you're discussing something called SDR, and there was a lot of dropouts to your signal, so repose your question, Dave. We didn't hear the question. It's got something to do with SDR. That you want to put up a whole lot of SDR receivers. You still got to, you need a lot of capture area of antenna to get enough signal above threshold. I could tell you how weak that signal is out of those 8 billion miles between us and Pluto. When a signal goes that far, at the inverse square law, it gets extremely weak. Over to you, Dave, K2RIW.
Negative, negative. You know, I think of just the signal going, you know, going to satellite and coming back down. Is there maybe 12 or 15 or 18 satellites, you know, stations are in orbit around the world, you know? They could be used to reflect a worldwide network for SDR and internet, also internet transmission and reception. Go ahead.
Do you want to use that network to listen to the signal coming from the New Horizons spacecraft? Is that what you're advocating, Dave? Go ahead.
Well, the New Horizons spacecraft could be sort of like an instrument that could send signals and receive signals. Go ahead.
Yes, but it is 8 billion miles away. The signal you send to it gets extremely weak when it gets there. The signal it sends back is extremely weak when it gets here. If you don't have an acre of antenna capturing area, you're not going to get enough of that signal that you can use. How are you going to create an acre of antenna capture area in order to be able to hear the weak signal from New Horizons? Over to you, Dave.
I think that, you know, if the signal is weak, that's one thing. Depending on how far away it is, probably doesn't matter as much. It's like if you have a signal coming from Pluto, a signal coming from the moon. If there's a way to amplify it, there's a way to receive it. You know, I think it probably doesn't make so much of a difference how far away it is. So, you know, if it's closer, it probably would work better.
If you're listening to a signal coming from the moon, and then you listen to the exact same signal strength transmitted to a signal coming from Pluto. I don't know the exact number, but the signal from Pluto might be 100 decibels weaker. And you think you're just going to add 100 decibels of extra receiver gain. On paper, that sounds good. All of that gain you're adding has noise associated with its amplification. You just can't simply put 100 dB of extra gain in there without listening to the noise of your own front end of your own amplifiers. If you don't gather enough signal in watts, picowatts, nanowatts, if you don't have enough area to gather enough signal coming from New Horizons, it's not going to be above threshold of no matter what hardware you use. Use a zillion SDR receivers if you want to. Use a zillion satellites if you want to. If you don't have an acre of area gathering that signal from New Horizons out at Pluto, it's not going to be above threshold of any equipment that you can build on planet Earth, so to speak. This was Technet. I know that this doesn't sound logical at first. You'll hear more of those details next week if you want to, David and George. This was Technet number 1625 and Space Report number 225. We got into a couple of controversial areas. But we'll be back next week, and we're going to settle a few of these. Can you imagine that signal when it comes down to the Earth is almost 5,000 Earths in diameter? As narrow as it is, from the best focusing you can get out of that dish, Paul. I'm going to turn it over to you first, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and TechNet, you got it, Paul.
Very good, good topic. We're going to look for it's called the Laser Communications Relay Demonstration for 2019. So shoot that one to the moon. I believe SpaceX has a contract for that. And that's going to be, you know, the laser. And they've done this before, but it's, you know, on a smaller scale, but it's going to be a big time scale. So, very good. 73, good net. Let me turn over to John for his comments. Until next week. WS2N clear.
82FRU comment.
John first. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for joining the net this week and ask everybody to come back next week. I'll cut it short because I know we have somebody waiting. But thank you for the questions and the opportunity to serve. KC2WGB.
Okay, sounds like George has another solution. Go right ahead, George.
Not a solution. It's not a solution at all. It's just dreaming into the future. And who's to say that Antarctica itself may be that ground plane antenna? Who's to say that? That a 100, 200...
Okay, let's see now if I can give you enough signal that you can hear. Antarctica has enough area. Antarctica is aimed in the wrong direction. The New Horizons is out there above your equator. It's not above the south. So you're not going to hear the top of the all of that air. Getting a signal into the sky. As I was starting to say, Antarctica may have enough area, but it's aimed due south. New Horizons is over your equator. So Antarctica is not aimed right, and although it's got enough area, you've now got to have an exact parabolic shape to the nearest full fraction of an inch in order to properly focus that signal. Antarctica doesn't have that shape. So there's a lot of details here you have to worry about. to make a big antenna work right. That Goldstone 240-foot dish has a very specific shape. So, what's your deep question for next week, Joe? The B2RYY, B2RYW?
Well, I'll give you a hint. It's something I heard in the news about a week or so ago, give or take. Google and another company are working together to put some sort of fiber optic system across the Atlantic, between USA, I think that's the East Coast, to some place in Spain. And they claim this circuit will be able to deliver 160 terabytes of information can be delivered over the circuit in 2 to 3 seconds. They said that's equivalent of all the books in the Library of Congress. What do you think about that?
Is this a fiber optic undersea cable you're discussing, Joe? Go ahead.
I believe that's what they said it is.
Yeah, fiber has got a lot of capability of a whole lot of signal, a whole lot of bandwidth, and I can believe that. And so, no matter what kind of communication system you got, whether it be to your cell phone, to your internet connection, to your desktop computer, whatever, we always want more bandwidth, more capability. There's no end to that. So there's going to be continuous developments in that area. And so, does that particular portion of the world that we really want to, is that the portion of the world that we've got to have the highest possible data rate to? How do they choose that one as the first one, as opposed to Europe? Over to you, Joe.
I didn't read any more details on it. I guess probably Spain is maybe a gateway to go into Europe. Maybe it was easier cost-wise to put the thing into Spain because that's maybe the closest physical point to put it to, or Portugal. I think they said Spain someplace. So maybe that's, you know, they mentioned that they wanted to get you know, much higher bandwidth coming and going into the Europe area, into EU. So that's their thinking. I didn't read any more about it. I probably could if I just, you know, type in a couple words on Google someplace. I could probably find some articles on it. But my question is related to that subject, but specifically, you'll have to wait till next week.
The very first undersea cables, they sunk roughly 1860, only operated for a few months, and it could send slow speed Morse code. We've come a long way since then, Joe.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And I put connectors in the end of fiber cables and how strong it is and how it, how delicate the stuff is actually in reality. It's amazing stuff to work with. But to be continued next week. Have yourself a good evening. And so long for now. I mean, it's a Roy.
Think big, high data rates. Bye-bye for now. John, what is the weight of an Alaskan Malamute dog, female, run to the litter in that case, T2RIW? Are you there, John? How copy? I'm hearing you, and I'm hearing me coming out of 8.5 and out of 3.75. Apparently John is not, at least wasn't. An Alaskan Malamute dog, the runt of the litter there in female, how heavy would that be, John? A buddy of mine had an Alaskan Malamute, and he thinks it's the best dog in the world. I'm hearing you beautifully, John. Go ahead. John, Roy is coming out of 3.75. He doesn't come out of 8.5. I believe I'm coming out of both. KC2WGB, K2RIW. I'm always hearing Roy coming out of 3.75. Yeah, you're hearing him on the input, and he's coming out of 3.75, but he's not coming out of 8.5. So, an Alaskan Malamute, a female run to the liver there, I wonder what that would weigh, because, as I said, a buddy of mine had a Malamute, and he thinks it was the best dog in the world. Okay, not quite as massive on top. For what you desire, is that better or worse, John? You like a massive top dog? You want a chesty dog? Okay, and you didn't choose Malamute because you fell in love with Swiss Mountain Dog. Somebody introduced you to a Swiss Mountain Dog, you fell in love, and that's it. Poor dear John. What color was Cookie? And what's the usual color of a Swiss Mountain Dog? With fur that thick, my guess is the dog has a slightly rough time on a high humidity, hot summer.